This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, February 28, 2005. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. As a suicide bomber in Iraq claims the lives of at least 115 people, we'll hear from the likely Prime Minister, Ibrahim al-Jafari. The Prime Minister of Lebanon resigns amid protests and the possibility of a vote of no confidence. And it's been 1 year since U.S. Marines took former Haitian Prime Minister Jean-Bertrand Aristide into exile. We'll hear the latest from Port-au-Prince. These stories and more after these headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The Israeli government has approved a new route for the separation wall and plans to expand settlements in the occupied West Bank. Manar Jebrin reports from the International Middle East Media Center.
The Israeli government is planning to build at least 6,391 new housing units in the West Bank settlements. At the same time, the government officials are talking about implementing its unilateral disengagement from the Gaza Strip and four small West Bank settlements. Palestinian observers accuse the Israeli government of distracting the international opinion and negatively affects peace efforts. Dr. Jad Ishaq of the Applied Research Institute of Jerusalem described the Israeli settlement policy as a land grab.
What we see on the ground that Israel is trying to link disengagement plan with an attempt to further reinforce its grab on the West Bank and to totally Israelize Jerusalem. This was evident in the cabinet decision last week, where the cabinet voted on the disengagement plan from Gaza and at the same time approved the new route of the fence.
Expanding settlements with the current route of the wall will evacuate more Palestinians from their land. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Manar Jibrin from IMEMC Palestine.
Veterans for Peace activists rallied at a local Veterans Affairs Center, calling on the government to provide proper testing of soldiers who may have been adversely affected by U.S.-made depleted uranium weaponry. Melinda Tuhus reports from New Haven.
Joseph D'Amico is a Marine reservist on active duty who was at the rally.
Yeah, I'm holding a sign for depleted uranium, you know, which is a current problem. You know, could be the Agent Orange of today from what they say.
D'Amico was referring to the powerful defoliant used in the war in Vietnam, which caused serious health problems for vets and their families, problems which were dismissed by the U.S. government for decades. State Representative Pat Dillon has introduced a bill that calls for voluntary testing of U.S. soldiers returning to Connecticut from Iraq and Afghanistan.
The Department of Defense is saying that depleted uranium doesn't really pose a health risk, and yet we have a lot of soldiers who seem to have very odd health effects when they come back.
The DOD already does some testing for depleted uranium, but according to the National Gulf War Resource Center, the test it uses doesn't pick up most exposures. Dillon's bill would allow for independent testing. In addition, she hopes to set up a registry to track returning veterans, which would give valuable information to healthcare providers if illnesses start appearing. For FSRN, I'm Melinda Tuhus in West Haven, Connecticut.
Native American tribes organized an objection to a Bush administration judicial nominee for the first time in their history. Stephanie Edgley explains why from D.C.
The National Congress of American Indians is opposing the confirmation of William Myers for a seat on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals because they claim he is biased and beholden to special interests. The group says Myers is unfit to be a judge because they say he will be unable to give the National Congress of American Indians a fair hearing if one of their cases was brought to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. Tex G. Hall, president of the National Congress of American Indians, describes Myers' past prejudices against the group.
Myers claimed he was unable to meet with tribal leaders because of the September 11 attack. But Myers' own records show that he met with the mining industry representatives on September 13, 2001.
The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals oversees nine western states and 430 Indian tribes, which make up 77% of the nation's federally recognized tribes. Myers' nomination currently sits in the Senate Judiciary Committee. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., this is Stephanie Edgerly.
The Coalition of Immokalee Workers has started another tour for economic justice and human rights by targeting one of the country's largest fast food giants. Andrew Stelzer reports from the tour, now in Florida.
Two busloads of farm workers, most of them Mexican and Guatemalan, left Immokalee, Florida at 7 a.m. Each bus will visit several cities throughout Georgia, Alabama, Tennessee, Kentucky, Illinois, and Indiana, holding rallies outside Taco Bell restaurants and speaking to church and community groups about the four-year-old boycott. The fast food chain buys tomatoes from South Florida growers, and the coalition says they should use their buying power to force farmers to pay higher wages. Next week, the two buses will meet up in Louisville, Kentucky, the corporate headquarters of Yum Brands. Yum owns Taco Bell and is the biggest fast food restaurant owner in the world. Yum refuses to give in to the coalition's demands for a penny per pound raise for picking tomatoes and a promise to get guarantees from the farmers who sell to Yum that workers are not being treated inhumanely. Currently, tomato pickers earn less than $8,000 a year and get no benefits, no overtime, and have no right to organize. For FSRN, from the Taco Bell Truth Tour on I-75 in North Florida, I'm Andrew Stelzer.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
Syrian-backed Lebanese Prime Minister Omar Karami has resigned amid mass protests and the threat of a no-confidence vote from the parliament. Protesters have filled Beirut's streets since the assassination of former Prime Minister Rafik Hariri, calling for the resignation of the Prime Minister as well as the President and the immediate withdrawal of the nearly 15,000 Syrian troops in Lebanon. However, Hariri's recent assassination and Karami's resignation today has people in neighboring Jordan claiming that current events in Lebanon are part of a plan by the U.S. and Israel to gain more footing in the Arab world. Joining us to talk about the situation is Tujan Faisal, former Jordanian parliamentarian and political analyst. How are people receiving the news of Karami's resignation in Jordan?
The general attitude towards the upheaval of the opposition, or what the so-called opposition, is not very positively received here in Jordan, and I think in general in the Arab world, because it's considered as the assassination of Hariri was an attempt made by United States or Israel to overthrow the government and to pressure Syria into signing a peace treaty. So the general attitude is not favorable here.
And can you tell us who makes up this so-called opposition in Lebanon?
I think everybody brought his own agenda, and they are using Hariri's death. I think Hariri was the sacrificial lamb because he wasn't one of those deeply rooted leaderships of ethnic and religious groups in Lebanon. And I think that is why he was chosen to be the sacrificial lamb. So Hariri's death will pass and everybody will forget him. They pay him lip service and homage. And everybody brings his own agenda, and their agendas are not one and the same. They just wanted to overthrow the government. So that's why I say now it's a real test for them, because the Arabs await a stand that will fit the Arab solidarity and the Arab best interests, and they'll be soon accused of siding with the enemies, you know, if they don't take Arab stands. And it's going to be easy for them to do that because now they owe the United States.
And what will Syria do next? Will they give in to the Israeli and U.S.-backed peace pact?
Yeah, the issue of next is the real test for this so-called opposition, because it is segmented of heterogeneous fractions that used to fight a few years ago. And they are using Hariri's death. And what they do next is the real test for them. And I think Karami had a hard time about the last couple of weeks. But now the opposition will have a hard time in proving itself much more qualified than the government they overthrew.
Tujan Faisal is a former Jordanian parliamentarian and a political analyst. She joined us today from Jordan. In Haiti, police killed at least one and injured others after firing into a crowd of several hundred unarmed demonstrators today who were marching through the Port-au-Prince neighborhood of Bel-Air in commemoration of the one-year anniversary of exiled former President Jean-Bertrand Aristide's ouster. Witnesses say one person was killed and a worker at the morgue confirmed a police ambulance delivered two bodies shortly after the shootings. A UN Brazilian peacekeeper said that police dressed in desert camouflage had killed the man, 26-year-old Stanley Blott. He also reported that police had fired in the direction of the UN troops. Firing shots into the air, officers identified in Blott's killing surrounded the body so a police ambulance could take him away. Residents of Bel Air yelled at the police and pleaded with Brazilian peacekeepers to stop them, as bodies taken away by police officers are sometimes never seen again. 1 year after U.S. Marines whisked Haiti's former president Jean-Bertrand Aristide into exile in Africa, Haitians are expressing rising discontent with the interim government that has replaced him. Aristide's supporters from poor urban areas continue to call for his return, and even some of Aristide's enemies are demanding the prime minister's resignation. Meanwhile, promises of international aid have fallen short, and a nine-month-old UN peacekeeping mission has been ridiculed for failing to stop crime or prevent human rights abuses. Reed Lindsay reports from Port-au-Prince, Haiti.
No, I see no peace, you understand?
In the city of Cap-Haitien on Sunday, hundreds of Aristide supporters marched through the streets under a searing sun to commemorate the one-year anniversary of his controversial departure.
Monsieur Bush, Monsieur Chirac, bring my president Haïti back to my country.
Aristide's return seems highly unlikely. Less certain is the fate of his successor, Interim Prime Minister Gerard Latortue, who in recent weeks has faced mounting criticism even among sectors of the elite which once backed him. Last week, a group of political parties demanded Latortue's resignation after an assault on the national penitentiary freed more than 480 prisoners. But amid a stagnant economy and ongoing violence, it is the poor, as usual, who have suffered the most. It's raining in the northern city of Cap-Haitien, and water drips through dozens of cracks in Mamot Bien-Aimé's rusted sheet metal roof in the slum of La Fossette. Bien-Aimé says she hasn't had enough money to fix the roof, especially since she stopped selling used clothes on the street 4 months ago, due to rising prices and dwindling customers. She says her situation began going downhill when the former soldiers that helped oust Aristide invaded Cap-Haitien on February 22, 2004. The following day, her 29-year-old sister was shot and killed by soldiers while she tended her laundry.
I'm still breathing, but after they killed Mimine, I'm not in good health. After they killed her, I was in shock. Since then, I haven't been well. I have terrible headaches.
While the U.S.-backed government has staked its mandate on fighting crime and stamping out armed pro-Aristide groups based in the slums of Port-au-Prince, violence has raged on in recent days. On Friday, five people in the pro-Aristide slum of Bel Air were shot and killed during a police operation. Witnesses say the victims were unarmed and executed by black-clad hooded officers, the latest in a spate of summary executions allegedly committed by police.
We don't need you here. Go home. Go. That we have to go home. We don't need you here.
Residents of Bel Air took their anger out on the UN, throwing rocks and shouting obscenities at the Brazilian peacekeepers who had provided backup to the police. Shortly after, a Brazilian was wounded by gunfire that appeared to come from pro-Aristide militants. The incident marks the growing frustration among Haitians with the UN peacekeeping mission, which is blamed with not providing security and failing to deliver on promises of more than $1 billion in international aid. Brazilian General Augusto Heleno leads the UN peacekeeping troops in Haiti.
We aren't aware of all the operations that the police do. There are operations that we are aware of, and there are others that are sudden or a quick response of which we aren't aware. The police go because they have some information, and they do the operation alone. We are not troops of investigation. The country has judicial powers for that.
For his part, Latortue has refused to resign and has vowed to lead the nation to presidential elections scheduled for next November. But many poor Haitians, already cynical of their young democracy, say they will not participate. This man, who asked not to be named, lives in the violence-torn slum of God's Village, a neighborhood patrolled by Sri Lankan peacekeepers where gangs murdered at least 10 people last week.
Elections are held and the people put the president in power, senators in power, every authority in power, and after that, they forget us. They pick up 1,000 bourgeoisie who are similar to them and millionaires. Those who are already at the top go higher, and ourselves, we fall further down.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Reed Lindsay from Port-au-Prince, Haiti.
A suicide car bomber struck a medical clinic in Hilla, 60 miles south of Baghdad today, killing at least 115 people and wounding at least 132. Another car bomb in nearby Musayib killed at least one police officer. Iraq's insurgency shows no signs of halting, even as the man who's likely to be the next prime minister has few ideas for how to end it. David Enders interviews Ibrahim al-Jafari in Baghdad.
Inside his office in a palatial home that once belonged to one of Saddam Hussein's ministers and now sits inside the heavily fortified Green Zone, the former exile who is likely to be Iraq's next prime minister professes to be a simple man. Jafari, a 58-year-old medical doctor and the head of the Dawa Party, many of whose members were forced to leave the country in 1980 to avoid Saddam Hussein's purges, fled first to Syria and then to Iran, where he lived until 1989 before moving to London. His nomination by the United Iraqi Alliance, the coalition of mostly conservative Shiite parties that won most of last month's vote, is the product of a week of political negotiations and infighting, and Jafari offered an indictment of the entire transitional process.
I hope in the next round to have direct elections. That way the prime minister is chosen by the people and not by lists or agreements among politicians, where we won't really know if the people want that person.
The UIA claimed the backing of Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, Shiism's top cleric, which drew protests from many Shiite clerics who said it was impossible Sistani would involve himself in politics to the extent of endorsing a single party. Jafari is unapologetic and smiles broadly when asked about Sistani, whose picture the UIA featured on many of its posters, along with the slogan, endorsed by the Marjaiya, or religious authority.
If he didn't like that list, he wouldn't have agreed to have his picture on the posters.
Jafari has ignored the calls of rebel cleric Muqtada al-Sadr and the Muslim Scholars Association, the group of Sunnah clerics who have been at the fore of calling for a boycott of the political process, who recently renewed their demands that a date for withdrawal of foreign troops be set before they will take part.
There is a difference between occupational forces and multinational forces. Now we have multinational forces under the umbrella of United Nations. They are presenting here to support our security. When we are going to depend on ourselves, and we can fill this the vacuum, security vacuum, that time we can tell them, please, thank you very much, you have to go out of Iraq. But now, in spite of their presenting here, in spite of many soldiers have been killed from then here with our people, still the security is not good.
Jafari also said he would reevaluate current Prime Minister Ayad Alawi's repeal of some of former U.S. proconsul Paul Bremer's debathification orders, meaning that some members of the former government who have recently been allowed to return to work might once again be barred. In Baghdad, I'm David Enders reporting for Free Speech Radio News.
Local and international pressure has forced Togo's interim president to step down. Fornia Singbe, who was handpicked as interim president by the Togolese military after his father's death, said he quit the post in the national interest. Nia Singbe, however, says that he will contest presidential elections slated for April. But as leaders of five African countries led by Nigeria meet in Togo to discuss the elections, there are fears that the military will influence them. Sam Olukoya reports from Lagos.
Farouk Basingbe agreed to step down as interim president after a meeting with President Olusegun Obasanjo of Nigeria. Nigeria is one of the countries at the forefront of the opposition to Basingbe's emergence as interim president. Nigeria's legislators even authorized President Obasanjo to take military action if Basingbe refused to step down. Basingbe says he will contest presidential election now scheduled for April. Sylvester Odion Akhene of the Center for Constitutionalism and Demilitarization in Lagos says he is likely to win the election given that he may be the choice of the Togolese military.
The military has been quite powerful in the politics of Togo. And this is a general trend in Africa. So in the case of Togo, I mean, it's very, very likely that the military, of course, whoever the military supports, might emerge at the end of the day as the leader of that country. And from the succession drama that has taken place so far, Ifaure, you know, the son of the late president of Togo, decides to contest, you know, it is very likely that he might win.
Before he died in office early this month, former President Eyadema, who is Gbazengbe's father, ruled Togo as a dictator for 38 years. Many Togolese, like Victoria Dovier, say they hate the prospect of his son taking over from him.
For me, I don't pray for any member of Eyadema's family to come to power. We are suffering in Togo.
International relations expert Tony Iyare says for Togo to move forward democratically, its politics has to be broadened to allow for opposition forces who were suppressed during Eyadema's iron-fisted rule.
You see, what is important is that Togo definitely require a fresh breath of life. You need fresh forces, you know, to propel the Togolese project and development. So what is important is that for Togo to survive, there is a need to extend the political space so that all players, including Faure himself, you know, let all of them face the election.
There are fears Togo could descend into chaos if a winner, not generally acceptable to the people, emerges as president when elections are held in April. If this happens, Nigeria, the superpower of the West African sub-region, will be saddled with the responsibility of intervening, possibly through military means, as it did in some other countries in the region. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Lagos.
A bill taken up by the U.S. Senate today would make it tougher for people to erase debt by filing for bankruptcy. The bill is backed by banking and credit card industries, who say it would benefit the average consumer who ends up paying for other people's bankruptcy claims within their own credit card bills. But consumer rights groups call the legislation a handout to the financial industry, noting that the bill does not address aggressive marketing schemes by credit card companies and that half of the people who file for bankruptcy are facing expensive medical charges. Mitch Jezerich reports.
For the past 7 years, banks and credit card companies have been pushing a bill to make it harder for people to erase debt by filing for Chapter 7 of the Bankruptcy Code. This could be the year it becomes law. After passing out of the Senate Judiciary Committee last week by a 12-7 vote, Republican chair of the committee, Arlen Specter, brought the measure to the Senate floor, where he hopes to have it passed in the next few weeks.
There are some who use bankruptcy as a means of avoiding debts which they have the ability to pay. Some bankruptcy filers have the ability to pay a significant portion of their debts, but the current bankruptcy system, which presumes that most people are acting honestly, does not require them to do so.
The bill would require persons who earn at least the median income in their state to file under Chapter 13 of the Bankruptcy Code that requires them to repay their debt. Chapter 7, which permits people to erase their debt, would then only be available for those who earn below their state's average income. Half of the people who file for bankruptcy do so because of astronomical medical bills. Ranking Democrat on the Judiciary Committee Pat Leahy says the bill does not address the financial institution's role in reckless marketing.
You know, it's relatively easy to obtain credit. We tell the stories of your neighbor's dog getting a $3,000 pre-approved credit card. Your kid goes to college, they get inundated with pre-approved credit cards.
Financial institutions have spent tens of millions of dollars in lobbying for the bill on Capitol Hill, as lobbying has become the modus operandi for those with money since finance campaign reform has limited political donations.
Finance companies, credit card companies, banks spend a lot of money on lobbying in efforts to convince elected officials and their staffs that bankruptcy reform is something the nation needs.
Stephen Weiss is with the Center for Responsive Politics. Though the center takes no position on the bill, Weiss says it's important for the public to know who's paying to support it.
The American Bankers Association itself contributed more than $2.2 million to federal candidates and parties during last year's elections. That's just from the association itself. It does not include the many millions more that the association's members, banks across the country, have given themselves.
Most of the people that file for bankruptcy will not be affected by this bill.
Laura Fisher is a spokesperson for the American Bankers Association. She says the bill would only affect the people who have the means to pay their debt. Fisher also says it's not the financial institutions, but the everyday consumer who ends up footing the bill for Chapter 7 bankruptcy claims.
Because of bankruptcy, each family pays an additional $400 a year for goods and services and increased credit rates. That money that people can't pay back does go back into the economy, and we all end up paying for it. So we would like to discourage some of the people, encourage them to repay some of their debts so we can eliminate some of the money that does go back into the economy.
Though the bill has bipartisan support, in years past it has been stopped due to an amendment that would bar anti-abortion activists who commit crimes at clinics from filing for bankruptcy so to avoid paying court damages. Democratic Senator of New York Chuck Schumer says he'll attempt to add the amendment again.
Many of these militant groups, which overall are less active than they were a few years ago, so there's less activity, but they have on their websites, last time I checked, one of them makes you pledge that you will go into bankruptcy if you're successfully sued.
Similar amendments in years past have caused Republicans in the House to drop the bankruptcy bill altogether, saying it unfairly targets anti-abortion activists. With Democrats losing ground in the Senate after the 2004 elections, it's unclear whether Schumer will have enough support to tack on the abortion amendment again this year. Mitch Jezerich, Free Speech Radio News.
Over the weekend, a broad coalition of students came together in Washington, D.C. to protest the global AIDS crisis. The D.C. Radio Co-op brings us the voices of some of the people working to fight AIDS and HIV, both locally and across the globe.
Thousands gathered in D.C. on February 26th to demand government accountability for HIV policy failings. The Student March Against AIDS brought youth and young adults from across the country to rally in front of the White House, followed by a march to the Capitol. Organizers of the National March were supported by local D.C. groups who were on the front lines of the local battle against HIV. 1 in 20 people in D.C. are infected with HIV. Hermens Mitsotsa works at the Latin American Youth Center as an HIV and substance abuse educator.
Sadly to say is that the youth abroad probably have more information about HIV and the impact it has in the world than our youth here in the city schools.
Youth have one of the fastest growing rates of new HIV infections in the U.S. and make up more than half of the 5 million people infected each year around the world. Personal experience is a driving factor for taking action, says Sarah Dello.
We actually grew up with AIDS in our lives. It's not something that just came about, and we realize that it's affecting our generation directly, both domestically and internationally, and so people are ready to act. With anything that you study in class, AIDS is related, whether it's economics, government, English, AIDS is everywhere.
As a member of Georgetown University's AIDS Coalition, Sarah Dello has a message for policymakers.
They need to wake up and start paying attention because for too long people are just ignoring what's going on with AIDS. They act like they're acting, but they're not. They need to go further. We need comprehensive sex ed in our high schools. We need to fund the Global Fund. We need to fund the Ryan White Care Act. And we're here to make sure they know that.
Following the student march against AIDS, hundreds of protesters rallied outside the Embassy of India. They were calling on the Indian Parliament to resist pressure from international financial organizations to change patent laws. Without the generic AIDS medications made in India, many people living with HIV in Africa and Asia would not have access to life-saving drugs, says Radcheka Jamurka, an organizer of the rally.
Essentially, AIDS medication is in trouble, and we want people in India to reconsider it and then go ahead with the act. Probably change it or reject it totally.
The Indian Parliament has until June to revise its patent laws. For Free Speech Radio News with the DC Radio Co-op, I'm Rachel Wallace.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Aura Bogado.